This episode of AVXL is recorded on October 11th, 2018. We're going to talk about 4K HDMI cable mayhem, Sony's A9F OLED, early reviews for Samsung's 8K Q900, some of the shiny from Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, the new Chromecast, the joys of projector bulb life, and husky breath. All that and so much more coming up on AVXL.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home video and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And I am flanked by a collection of speakers in my living room that is going to have to be leaving my living room shortly.
Aw.
It's okay. They're going into the garage. I'm creating a dedicated listening room in my garage.
Good.
Yes.
You need room.
Yes. There will be significant increases in marital harmony.
There is a crowded speaker convention going on
right now. Yeah,
in
what do you got?
Many.
So the Tekton Mini Lures.
Yep.
Right next to ELAC Unifies. That Cambridge Audio amp I'm testing. An Emotiva Basics A100. There's just a lot going on in here. Subwoofer testing, however, will continue in the living room.
Understood.
You know, those are easier to hide. Ha ha.
Very cool.
So early reviews for the, how much was that 8K Samsung Q900?
The big one's 15 grand. The 88 inch. 88 or 82? 88, I believe. That's generally a pretty large LCD, yeah. Let alone one that can do decent HDR in addition to the wide color palette and 8K resolution on those brand new Samsung Q900 TVs.
For all your 8K content.
Yeah, and apparently Samsung in their QA test lab out in Jersey, one of my favorite buildings to stand in and work my butt off, apparently they provided an early access to one of the 85-inch 8K QLEDs.
Oh, wow.
And, I guess 85 inches, excuse me, not 88. Anyway, 15 grand for that one. We don't know pricing or availability yet for the smaller ones. They're saying the whole series launches at the end of the month, so about 2 more weeks, I guess we'll find out what the pricing is and everything else. Anyway, a few folks have already taken an early review at it from a Samsung hand-picked unit, which I'm sure looked absolutely fabulous. The takeaways for me, really, for the initial looks at this, I saw no deal breakers, at least in terms of looking at a factory-provided panel in a controlled environment. One thing related about the brightness of the TV, that 4,000 nit claim is only when you're using the TV's dynamic picture mode.
Okay.
So that to me is less impressive. The movie mode for HDR viewing will give you 2,000 nits. Still a pretty bright TV, but overall, not quite that 4,000 nits that you could achieve out of this TV if you switch it up to the more punchy dynamic picture mode, which I'm not sure why you would not use that mode in a controlled home theater setting. That would be good. Something fine for daytime viewing, of course, but
more punchiness.
The vision's getting dim or something. You're having eyesight issues. Everything looked good. And the real deal, though, in the end, will be testing with retail boxed units. And, of course, the smaller screen sizes just to see if everything holds true to what they've been showing off with the 85-inch Super Mamma Jamma Q900. And speaking of reviews, the good folks over at HDTV Test recently took a look at the brand new Sony A9F OLED television. It was a solid review overall, as I would personally expect from a Sony flagship television. Highlight for me really was that a TV's ability to become a center channel for your AVR setup. It actually has a sound mode that becomes very center channel-like, where you can then drive it with your AVR setup. I'm really curious to see how well that can be matched with other speakers, and in the end, is it even worth using? While this review focused mostly on video quality that I was checking out, I cannot wait to hear somebody really put this through its paces with a good AVR setup, with speakers they're very familiar with, so they can do some good A/B testing with that to see if it's even doable to use a TV as a center channel. It's a feature I've kind of wanted for a long time, especially if you're stuck with electronics or speakers that you normally aren't going to use otherwise. Sure.
There's two distinct challenges. One is whether or not it kind of sonically fits with the rest of your surround sound speakers. Given that, you know, your center channel is mostly going to be emphasizing dialogue is less of a challenge, right? Because the human voice is a fairly narrow chunk of the audio spectrum. The bigger challenge for me is that you're going to have to be able to match levels. And if you've got a serious set of speakers and a fairly powerful AVR and you listen at, man, I want to feel Black Panther, you know, deep.
And you're jiggling the OLED screen to make the sound.
Yeah.
So technically speaking.
Technically speaking.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about the leveling, let alone timing issues or just in general how the sound quality of that dual transducer system or actuators that provide the speakers basically on a vibrating sheet of glass in front of your face. So we'll find out. And I can't wait for somebody to actually put this more into the audio side of the home theater testing instead of just straight up the video side. However, on that video side, I am looking forward to seeing how well that Android-based Sony Spectracal app works for the auto calibration magic. Let's hope it's something closer to Dolby Vision rather than HDR10 in terms of AutoCal and the pain of AutoCal.
AutoCal is not making your life easier.
Not yet. No. Direct display control, on the other hand, is a beautiful thing. And that I appreciate. And I use that on quite a bit of TVs just to avoid menus and terrible remotes and things like that. I'd rather just have it in a chart and be able to go click, click, click with my computer and make those changes appropriately. We'll get into that later at some point.
It's funny because I'm looking at the A9F specs on the Sony website.
Glorious.
And the audio power output, 13 watts plus 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 10 watts plus 10 watts.
What?
And then speaker type, acoustic surface audio plus actuator plus subwoofer.
There's a lot of pluses there.
Okay.
Just that description alone doesn't give me hope, but we'll see. We'll see.
We should also point out that is a $3,500 television.
Oh, the 65-inch?
Apparently. It says starting at $3,499.99.
I don't even know if they make a 55-inch version of that TV.
Well, they're supposed to. A 55-inch and a 65-inch.
Premium.
Well, it's also, you're paying for Sony's processing, I think, more than anything else.
I would agree.
Yeah, $3,500 for the 55-inch, $4,500 for the 65-inch.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's list pricing. You can definitely find it cheaper than that if you shop around and wait a little bit. That is a fairly new TV.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to do a quick follow-up on our discussion about HDMI cables. I believe it was related to a viewer or a listener question we had. One thing I wanted to make clear, though, too, is that we were talking about the bandwidth of HDMI cables.
Right.
And when we talk about what comes out of a Blu-ray player with most Blu-ray movies, that's going to be 4K 24 with 420 color. And generally speaking, that will work just fine over a quote-unquote HDMI cable that's rated at 10.2 gigabits per second, not that max bandwidth. Now, HDMI 1.4, if we're going to talk about the ports for just a second, the older spec does not officially allow that 420 chroma subsampling, that color compression. However, NVIDIA and ATI added that support for that particular color format into their HDMI 1.4 graphics cards via driver a while back. Kind of off topic, but I just wanted to mention there are people who fudge it in other spaces as well.
Define fudge.
The shorter story would be that an HDMI cable that is rated at 10.2 gigabits per second should be able to deliver that full quality from a 4K HDR Blu-ray disc with no issues. And that's 10-bit color with the 420 color subsampling, the compression. However, there are a few discs out there that deliver 4K 60 HDR, like Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk in particular. Actually, that's the only one I know of. The bandwidth of playing that disc does exceed 10.2 gigabits per second and would require an appropriate cable to handle that. So that could be the one disc you drop in where everything was fine, everything worked, and then all of a sudden you're getting either no screen or an odd-looking screen. Also keep in mind that the bandwidth ratings include the actual AV signals as well as the bits used for encoding purposes. So you can think about the max data rate that we list for these cables is actually, in terms of that data being delivered across the cable, it's actually about 20% less than that spec'd rating. Just something to keep in mind. If you're running, say, like a bandwidth calculator on some video, you're trying to flow through it.
Right.
You'll never be able to hit 18 gigabit per second or 17 or 16. You got to get down to like 14 something before it'll actually...
And the
be
the,
happy.
It was funny because you posted a chart that Acoustic Frontiers LLC put together, and it's looking at 8-bit, 10-bit, and 12-bit color.
Different subsamplings.
Yeah, and from 4K 24 frames per second to 4K 60 frames per second, from 420 to 422 to 444. We don't actually have the bandwidth to do 10-bit or 12-bit 444.
Or RGB at at 60, 50, 60 frames a second.
Yeah.
So that's mostly, I think of that as PC use. You're trying to deliver a signal out of your computer that is 4K 60 at max color at least 10 bits. And that's where, we need HDMI 2.2 or whatever it's going to be.
Right.
So something to keep in mind there as well.
You know, 444 is supported, you know, by HDMI 2.0, but...
8-bit color, no problem.
Yeah. At 4K 30.
or on a computer, you can even do 4K 60 up to RGB as well, 444, as long as it's still 8-bit. It's when you make that transition into 10-bit or higher, you're adding some chroma subsampling to deal with it, or it ain't going to work.
I mean, but this is also more of a sort of an idealistic future-proofing kind of thing, not that there's a whole lot of 12-bit color coming out of discs at this point.
Nothing. Okay. Nothing. So that's just something to keep in mind. I'm not aware of any consumer 12-bit source devices, let alone 10-bit.
I mean, it was interesting.
10-bit, you're talking like Blu-ray players and things like that. And nowadays, computers, too, can provide that.
But. I mean, we saw some noise at CD about how people were doing 12-bit processing, but they were doing it with, like, to output 10-bit color.
Totally. Anytime you hear video processing, you want more than the final bit count's going to be for the display, because that just takes care of things like rounding errors and other potential forms of artifacts that can occur if you don't provide enough bits of video processing in terms of handling that color. Typically 12 to 14 bits or even higher in some cases is kind of norm. And I want to say a lot of the new chipsets are at least 12-bit in terms of the internal processing. When it's counting those ones and zeros and doing the matrix math. It wants a couple extra decimal places.
One of these identities has a future.
But I did take a look at the Monoprice website, though, and I think I'm going to order. I believe I found a 30-foot 4K cable. I don't believe it was using any kind of amplification or transmitters that are built into the chip, chips that would be built into the cable itself. We'll see. I just did a quick glance. It's like, what's the longest one I can buy right now with a chance of it working? And if that 30-foot cable works without using any fancy electronics, I'll be mightily impressed and a little curious exactly how they're doing it.
Let me know, because if that works, then that's what I'll yank through the ceiling.
May as well. You may not need 30 feet, but it's nice to know that you can just pick one of those up. And it was less than a buck a foot. So
I could probably do 20 feet.
Or it was about $1 a foot for that cable. So under 30 bucks for a 30-footer rated to the full 18 gigabit per second. 4K.
I'm okay with 4K. I really became okay with 4K at Cedia this year.
I hear you. For me, it's color.
It's pretty.
Give me that wide color palette. I need the pretty saturation. I need a deeper red.
Get this man
some richer green.
Color.
And a slightly different blue.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, RGB. I love you so much.
You know, there's something to be said for subtle color variances. It's just charming.
The tri-stimulus device and the eyeball.
Oh, my goodness. So, big festival this week from Google, the Pixel 3, the Google Home Hub, the Slate, which are respectively their next-generation phone. Sort of the device they're going to use to unify the Google Assistant and all of your home stuff.
The one with the screen on it.
Yeah.
But no camera.
Which is a big plus.
I like that. They were very... Their announcement was a little strange. It was bizarre to watch live in the sense of, I think they needed just a little more rehearsal, but who cares? I just want to know. Give me the details. That's all I really care about.
Yeah.
They can stumble through it all they want, but...
It's interesting. So we looked at a Lenovo hub that was similar with like a 10-inch screen, you know, voice control, Google Assistant built into it. And it's like $149. It looks good. Like, I think it's got that sort of generic, not exactly Etsy, not exactly something style. Like, I think it's just going to kind of blend in most environments.
Okay.
I'm kind of curious to play around with one, but not in any staggering rush at this point, because, you know, there's only so many... you know, voice devices I can fit in my garage before I start to get nervous. Yeah, it was interesting because the other thing is there's a nice write-up on Ars Technica where Ron Amadeo talks about how Google, quote, built a platform for smart displays and then didn't use it in the home hub. You know, this is their first kind of display that they've made for this, which is kind of catching them up to one particularly inferior display from Amazon on the Echo platform and one significantly improved one that just got announced.
On the Slate, they kept highlighting the color accuracy and how well the factory calibration was for that device for, you know, not only your video streaming, but also they were showing it to more professional users who might be very, very critical about color quality. And at least in the canned presentation, everyone was smiling and quite happy.
So Lenovo built their smart display. There was one from LG. Samsung bought Harman Kardon, which gives them Revell and JBL and a bunch of other companies a year or two ago. So JBL, which belongs to Samsung, did a smart display. All of those are running Android Things on a Qualcomm SD624, what they call their home hub platform. Android Things, you get an OS image from Google and you can't manipulate it or customize it. And Google's basically going to do all the updates for Android Things for 3 years with the idea that they were going to sort of lock down this ecosystem and not have to deal with you know, vendors delaying updates and stuff. You know, when you get into this article, Rahm Amadeo says he talked to DJ Jolly, the VP of Product Management, and found out that it's built on Google's Cast platform. Quote, so it's closer to a souped-up Chromecast than a stripped-down Android phone. It also doesn't use SD624 Home Hub platform. Instead, Google opted for an Amlogic chip, unquote. When he asked why did they do something different internally than what they gave to their third parties, Jolly said, quote, no particular reason. We just felt we could bring the experience to bear with Cast, and the experiences are the same. We would have easily given the third parties Cast if they wanted it, but I think most developers are comfortable using Android Things. Lenovo's got an 8-inch version of the smart display. It sells for $200, and this is like $50 less than that. So I feel like this is like another classic moment where Google has partnered with a bunch of people then undercut them, which is a little frustrating. If you're looking for sort of a home automation control device and you're already deep in the Nest or Google lifestyle, it's an option. The other thing that was funny is they dropped a new Chromecast. Was not mentioned in the Pixel 3/Google Home Hub/Slate Festival. They're saying it's like 15% faster, which mostly means it adds 1080p 60 frames per second support, should you have been desperate for that.
They're going to 4K 60 or 1080p 60?
1080p 60.
Interesting.
So you're still paying a bunch more money. It's funny, like, you can buy one right now at Best Buy or from Google's Play Store. It's a sleeker design. It's basically, you know, it's a smooth pebble. It's got a G on it. It does 1080p 60 frames per second. There's going to be a firmware update that's going to give it Chromecast audio style whole house music playback. So whatever it's connected to, you can play music on it along with the rest of your house. Still $35. You know, Sasha Sagan over at PC Mag had a pretty brutal article where he basically, opinion piece, I guess, where he basically says, you know, Chromecast is kind of losing the battle to Roku and Amazon. And the reason they didn't announce it at the press event is because it's failed, which I thought was harsh.
Really stopped using my Chromecast Ultra. That is a 4K device. I rarely use it because it still requires another device to drive it,
right?
Be it my phone or a tablet or something else. Whereas with something like my Roku Ultra,
yeah,
that's an all-in-one device with its own processor, interface. Don't need to go find my phone real quick to get something playing. Or if anything interrupts on the phone to cause the playback, I just get a smoother experience right with a dedicated device rather than trying to cast it. However, the one thing I absolutely love about the ability to cast a tab on my computer in particular is just that. It's simple. It works. It can be the desktop, a browser, a tab within the browser, and it just works. And it's a quick hack in terms of, wow, I've just got something on my computer and I just want to put it up on the TV. Boom. It just works.
I think that was one of the big things that kind of that Sasha was hammering on is that nobody wants to use their phone to control the television.
No, you know, and an app because it's all over the freaking map in terms of, you know, every app's got a different interface in terms of basic control. That's probably the biggest one for me. Or if something flubs within that app that's on your phone, maybe you had to restart your phone. That will often stop the playback of something. And it's like, a little too much integration.
It's been interesting because, you know, I've been running, iOS for so long. And what's been amazing to me is the number of times I have to reboot apps for no particular reason, or Bluetooth connectivity losses on, for example, in our car in the Honda, that I've never had a Bluetooth dropout, but, you know, I'll be in the middle of a phone call and Bluetooth will disconnect, reconnect 4 or 5 times. Like, I'll basically have to like pull over and use the phone on my ear because I can't keep it. It's been really peculiar. Now, this, you know, I'm not using a luxury phone, but it's a Motorola G6. You know, it's I'm pretty sure Motorola knows what they're doing at this point. But it amazed me, like, I've had to restart Sonos, Tidal. That Qobuz app is a hot mess. But I think that's because Cobuz is still kind of learning Android. But it's been this kind of the stability issues on Android have been kind of fascinating for me. Or maybe just apps are getting
kind
so
of brutal on my mobile device in particular in terms of having things running in the background. Mm-hmm. I purposely shut just about everything off. So
yeah.
it makes my phone the less than ideal device to be integrating into a home theater setup. It's much better to have that dedicated device that's whose sole purpose is to play my favorite apps and my favorite content rather than try to finagle the phone to do it. But I hear you. I'm ready for a new phone, and on my short list is going to be the new Pixel 3. I wish it had more storage. I wish it had an SD card slot. There's a couple little things like that that I would prefer. Like, I wish it had, like, double the memory and double the storage. I would have bought it, but at this point, it looks like I'm stuck with that 4 gig, 128 gig storage system. I'm really looking forward to it, though, actually. My phone's just old enough now, cooked in the sun properly over the last couple of years. And
it should be a pretty huge performance bump for you.
I would hope so. We'll see. We'll see.
We wait.
I'm looking forward to that nice new camera, though. The camera upgrade is what I'm really looking forward to.
The camera upgrade is going to be, like, terrifying for you.
Now that I've skipped a couple generations of other brands of phones, waiting on this one. Looking forward to it. They had better not dump, like, a 256 gig version, though, in a few months. Otherwise, that's the only thing holding me from pulling the trigger right now on it, so...
I don't imagine them dropping a surprise.
And I got to go check DisplayMate.com and see if they've done their thorough mobile analysis on that new Pixel 3.
Well, the Pixel 3 screen, everybody who's seen it says it's amazing.
I bet you it's a Samsung.
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, it's supposed to be an OLED.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Samsung, the biggest maker of OLED phones. Samsung.
Oh, my goodness. Sadly, I was not at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest / Can Jam 2018 last week. I do plan on being there next
year.
Man,
you missed out. It sounded awesome.
It's interesting to, at a distance, watch how these events are reflected through other people who write about audio. One of the things somebody pointed out is it's incredibly stupid to try to evaluate or comment on the quality of audio at an event like this because the rooms are often so atrocious.
Yeah.
Yeah, and on one hand, I get that, but it's also been interesting to watch because we've seen, at this point, you and I have seen a bunch of these at CES, and Lord knows I've seen a ton of these in Denver and several other places. Andrew Jones has a funny habit of, like, he walks in with a couple pieces of insulation, acoustic insulation, or I should say acoustic absorbent materials, panels, places them at the first reflection point on the sidewalls of a room, pops the speakers in place, and they generally sound fantastic. I have some questions about whether or not this is a legit environment, but it's also, you can't really condemn a speaker because it sounds horrible in a hotel room that's basically entirely.
Yeah, the best case scenario is your listening environment at a trade show is going to be a private suite somewhere.
Yeah.
Where you hopefully hear very little else, but still.
Yeah.
You're stuck with that room, that temporary setup.
Mm-hmm.
However, most of the things you're going to be listening to are going to be similarly handicapped.
Yeah.
So it's like, in a sense, you can also...
Part of the point, we can't find the article off the top of my head, but it was up on darko.audio. One of his legitimate points was you've got their source device, probably their source material if you can't play your own. You've got their amplification that you've got.
Yeah.
There's so many things. And that's on top of the fact that you're in a hotel room that's probably a miserable environment for audio. Michael Trey over at Sound and Vision did a really nice kind of look at a bunch of the stuff at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest 2018. Quote, two-channel heaven for audiophiles. And one of the reasons I'm calling this article out and putting the link in is because, you know, yes, he's there to see the crazy $5 billion speaker systems, but there's also one of the things that Rocky Mountain Audio Fest does is try to create rooms where there's like a $500 price point, a $1,000 price point, a $2,500 price point. And there's a lot of really good affordable stuff out there right now.
You know,
NAD
cool.
makes great stuff. ELAC makes great stuff. Benchmark had some new stuff that I just found out about. Some of the highlights, Focal delivered the first closed back headphone, the Allegia, which I'm looking forward to getting a chance to get ears on soon. On the ridiculous side of things, I thought it was interesting. Sony did an announcement and released the Signature Series DMP-Z1 headphone amplifier / player and the MDR-Z1R. So that's like a $8,500 player and a $2,300 set of headphones, if I have everything right. I wish I had the picture of the potentiometer. Yeah, this is a big sort of desktop audio player, and somebody, they had a cutaway model on display, and the potentiometer is like a chunk of brass with a bunch of soldering points out of the bottom of it and a big chunk of brass for the knob. The thing looks like it weighs 3 or 8 pounds, and I'm sure is a significant chunk of the $8,500 MSRP for that thing.
I'm sure those are hand-built.
I'm sure they
hand-tuned.
Are.
Hand-tuned. Probably gorgeous. And the materials, of course, sound delicious. But that, that ain't That ain't cheap.
The Z1Rs have been around for a while. You know, it's like two AKM AK4497 EQ DAX, and that potentiometer, that volume pot was just ridiculous. I'll see if I can find a picture of that. It reminded me, though, that I really want to hear FIO's M9 or FIO's M9. FIO's a Chinese manufacturer. They do super affordable quality audio gear. A lot of their audio players have had what I effectively refer to as interface issues. Like, everything sounds great, but getting the stuff to play can be this emotionally torturing experience. And they're kind of bringing up a whole new lineup of Android-based devices. The M7's up on Amazon now. It's like $200. The M9, I'm really curious to hear. Dual AK4490EN DAX, which is, you know, kind of overkill. They're also AKM DAX. You know, they're not quite as overkill as the pair of ones in that DMP Z1 that costs $8,500. This is also a $300 device. So the signal-to-noise ratio is 123 dB instead of 131 dB in the DAC, and it's like -112 THD/N instead of -116, all of which should be pretty much beyond what the human earball can hear. I haven't gotten a response back, but apparently there may be the possibility of this doing streaming services like Spotify and Tidal, which would be super badass at that $300 price, because a lot of the stuff in this is like Astell and Kern, and a lot of the others are super expensive. I heard good things from people that got ears on at Sennheiser's HD660, which is their newest addition to the 600 series. Something I saw at Cedia that a bunch of people were excited about at RMAF was JBL's reissuing the L100 Classic. This is like a legendary kind of 70s studio monitor.
Nice.
And I've always been fascinated by these speakers because they're one of those speakers that everybody talks about them in whispered tones. And JBL finally, I think, saw what they were going for on eBay. It was like, you know, we can reissue this speaker. It looks particularly awesome with the orange sort of egg crate foam on the front. They also apparently have their Ultima Salon 2 on display. That's Revell, actually, not JBL. I read some really good things about the Ryan 610, which is part of a demo with Pass Labs. Pass Labs being Nelson Pass. He's the guy who designed my AmpCamp amp, big friend of the DIY audio community, legendary amplifier designer, Class A audio stuff. I'm not sure if I'd call $2,000 a value bookshelf, but I'm me and generally don't review $50,000 speakers. And for companies that review, or magazines that review 50, or websites that review $50,000 or $75,000 speakers, $2,000 is like less than the sales tax. The Absolute Sound, for example, had a whole collection of $20,000 and up speakers, which I think is the only thing they've talked about from Rocking Down Audio Fest. B&W's 800DL, which is 30K, MBL's 101E Mark II Radio Strahler 4-ways. And we saw those, actually, the MBL speakers at Cedia last year. Those are the ones with the crazy sort of carbon fiber strips that look like sort of a carbon fiber sort of egg sculpture that radiates sound in 360 degrees.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, home theater and hi-fi.
Sounded good, too.
Yeah, they had an interesting note. Quote, the theory that you can overpower a room with too large a choice of speaker was squarely being turned on its head. And they were talking about Golden Ears having a pair of Triton reference speakers in a very, very small hotel room. Golden Ears has a tremendous reputation for delivering tremendous performance at relatively low prices. You know,
good to know.
Their flagship speakers are still more than I'm going to pay, but they're a hell of a lot less than $50,000 or $70,000 or even $30,000. Benchmark was showing off their LA-4 line amplifier, which is, I guess, similar to their HPA-4 minus the headphone outputs. The thing that was kind of confusing for me is that actually it's got a display on the front, but apparently it is not a DAC. It's designed to work with one of Benchmark's DAC 2 or DAC 3s or any other DAC. It's interesting because Benchmark's one of the first discrete DACs I ever took a look at. I want to say back in like 2000 or 2002 or somewhere around there. At the time, $1,500 seemed incredibly expensive, but compared to some of the insane prices we're seeing, like $18,000 DACs, it seems so reasonable by comparison. But
very cool.
I'm kind of curious to figure out more of what that display is used for on it. So we'll get back to that. It's the specs on it are kind of insane. THD 0.00006%, like -125 dB. A weighted signal to noise ratio of 137 dB. And something I particularly love, the volume control has 256 steps. So
nice.
I've found my iPhones really frustrating because there's like 64 steps, and invariably, whatever step I can get it to is a little bit higher or a little bit lower than what I want.
Oh, the pain.
I mean, it's a first world problem, but
still. Granularity is good.
I'm sure more is going to trickle out from Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, but not a ton of new stuff, but a lot of the things to do there is to go hear stuff you would normally never be able to hear.
A beautiful show.
Oh, my goodness. So sometime late last night, Epson sent out an email that the LP85 lamp I needed for my projector was in stock at Epson.com. I got really excited. And it was out of stock when I clicked the link at like 6:30 or 7 o'clock this morning. You know, so like they sent out the email at like 12:30. By 7 or 8, they were completely sold out. Or maybe
it was a short run.
Our projector's still going, right? But the bulb's closing in on 5,000 hours, which means it's dimmer.
Good to have one around.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is...
your calibration's probably changed by this point.
You know... the calibration's probably changed.
Some light has lost.
A lot of light is lost. And partially because I've been thinking for a while that, you know, it's just, it's feeling a little, because when we first had this projector up, even in summer sun, there was no difficulty in seeing the screen. It was bright enough. Manufacturers generally, they don't, the bulb doesn't explode at the end of its, well, it's in some cases
ideally,
it does, but that's another story.
It doesn't explode.
Yeah. But the idea is that similar to what we've heard from, for example, Dell talking about LEDs, like they put like, if you leave a Dell LED-based monitor on, a desktop monitor on for 3 years, 24/7, that's going to be pretty much done because it will be 50% as bright as it was when you bought it. So the number one thing you can do if you've just bought a desktop monitor is to turn the SOB off and not leave a screensaver run 24 hours a day if you want to maximize its life.
True.
You know, shut things off when you're done.
For myself, I just set it up within the OS to turn off the display after 10 minutes of nobody touching anything.
Yeah.
And then for me personally, I also use a hotkey program just to switch between the max and min brightness on the monitors.
Yeah.
So it's like I crank it up during the day and I turn it way the hell down at night or after hours. As soon as the sun goes down and my office is a little darker.
I'm pretty good about shutting off monitors because of somebody we used to work with a long time ago. I physically turned my monitor off so as not to tempt anyone.
Oh, I don't.
Should they walk up to my desk before the screen protector?
I was just trying to be conscious of energy consumption within the household. And so my immediate first step was just to go right into Windows and say, hey, look, don't turn the computer off right away, but feel free to kick that monitor off after 10 minutes. All I have to do is touch anything and it comes right back on.
Yeah. At this point, it's so ingrained. Just like I get up, I turn the monitor off. So it turns out I've been doing spectacular things for monitor life for me.
I've taped over all the power buttons and lights on my monitors. So I can't even really tell just from looking at a black screen if it's really on or not. But
feel for the heat above the monitor. But so, you know, a typical rating for example, the ELP. LP85, it's rated at 3,500 hours in standard mode or 5,000 hours in economic mode, which means since I'm pretty sure I'm running it in standard mode, I'm now probably well below 50% brightness on the bulb. And I should point out, part of the reason I'm frustrated by this is I'm really picky about where I buy lamps because there are a lot of bogus third-party lamps out there.
It's way more difficult than it needs to be.
Yeah.
It's like to find one actually from the manufacturer.
Yeah.
With their stamp of approval, you shouldn't have to have a problem finding that.
No, I mean, basically,
it should be quite easy.
I never, you know, I pretty much never order a bulb off Amazon. And it was funny because I just for fun, I searched for this bulb and I found one on Amazon and there was a bunch that were rated like 2 stars. There was one that was rated like 10 stars. I put the link up on FakeSpot. It was like, this is 80% bogus reviews. This account is associated with this account.
There's a lot of refurbished lamp modules out there where they'll buy the new lamp itself and then incorporate that into
the physical bulb.
Yeah.
And
then it comes down to what parts did they use exactly and who did it and how much is it used.
One of the first bulbs I bought was supposed to be the bulb that plugged into a projector, but they literally sent me the bulb and I was supposed to
swap it
out, tear apart the cartridge and install this, which is a non-trivial endeavor. And by the way, if you don't white glove it and keep everything perfectly clean, the bulb's going to explode from your fingerprint grease the first time you fire it.
The other thing about buying a refurbished item too, you have to really stare at those bulbs to make sure they're really, really clean.
Yeah.
Can't have any oils or from your fingers or whatever on there. Otherwise, it's going to pop. It's going to pop with a quickness, so...
which is bad. I've tried third parties, but I'm a little uptight about it. Like, I'm probably going to end up ordering a bulb from B&H Photo or Adorama because I think their supplies are okay. My second bulb lasted less than half as long as the first bulb, and it shattered inside the projector, and that was when I kind of decided that I was going to buy, you know, bulbs from as close to the factory as possible in the future. And also, you know, one of the things you should consider if you're buying a projector, because Robert and I are pretty gung-ho about projectors in general, it's nice to see that the projector bulb prices have dropped. Because I want to say that the projector I had, which I bought refurbished for $600 or $650, the replacement bulbs were like $289 for it. The replacement bulb at that point was half the cost of the projector. With this one, the replacement bulb is like $99, which
That's
is
nice.
Significantly less painful. But the reason why we're so excited about laser projectors, other than, you know, the idea of lasers, is because laser projectors are rated to 20,000 hours, 30,000 hours, 3,011,474 zillion hours, probably like 20,000 hours.
It's not to say that the quality of the light can't change
right.
over time with a laser-based illumination system, but you generally have that extreme long life in terms yeah. of it at least lighting up and lighting up at a consistent level.
Yeah, just make sure your projector shuts down when you're not using it. That was one of the challenges I had with that first Kavo I tested.
Jeez, especially projectors.
Where the Kavo would shut down, but it wouldn't shut my projector down. Oh. So I probably put an extra 600-800 hours on that bulb early.
And when you do
spring.
Swap the lamp module out, you can go in and hit that reset button on the counter mm-hmm. with built into the projector that tells you how many hours and gives you that fresh 0000 level again.
It's always good to hit the zero button.
Heck yeah.
Oh my goodness. I've been playing around with the new Kavo.
Digging it?
I'm digging it. There's some interesting stuff. It's a little erratic in shutting down. The power button's a little erratic, which I don't particularly understand why that is. And there'll be situations where it seems like the Kavo shuts down, but it doesn't shut down my equipment. So I gotta send an email to those guys and ask if there's some setting in there I'm missing. Because I do want my projector to time out, because the Kavo will seem to keep the projector on long after the 20 minute timeout.
Are you alive?
Yeah.
Are you alive?
It's like, stop that! But so far, so good. It's a lot less fraught than the original Kavo. It's also a quarter of the price, which is a non...
Ooh, one last tip for your projector bulb scenario. Anytime you're going to swap a lamp module out, it's a good time just to dust the damn thing down, too. Yeah. Most of these larger projectors often have
filters,
air
too.
Filters. Yeah, and check it. It's often a cheap part to replace if it needs to be, or you can just clean them.
Yeah.
But just take a look and see how it survived for the time you gave it. And that'll give you a good idea what you can expect for the next round. Keep it cool.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'm going to play around with is the Kavo Control Center should work with both Google Home and Alexa. And I am curious to see how playing with that or with the Sonos, how it works in the sense of being able to do a lot of the home automation stuff that you can do with the Harmony remote. So we will see how that goes.
Looking forward to it.
We got a great question from Craig. Looking for help. He's ordered a TV. Well, you know what? Let me just read Craig's email. He says, "Hi, guys. Love the show. I've heard Robert talk favorably about some of the Hisense TVs, and I'm considering one for a purchase in the next month or two. It's a Hisense P8. However, it seems to be a model that is unique to Australia." He's got a link to jbhifi.com.au. A few questions. Are you able to tell if this is a model you know by another name? Do you think this would be a decent mid to high range TV for someone with a budget of up to Australian $3,000? I've noticed that the models you mentioned on the show often aren't available in Australia. Are you able to offer any advice with regards to comparing TV models in general when they may have another model name outside the US? Do you have to fall back to just looking at a list of features? Thanks for your time and thoughts. Cheers, Craig.
Sometimes you do. Sometimes yeah. you got to dig through what the specs are on a particular TV.
Yeah.
The thing that jumped out to me for the P8, which is not a model I'm familiar with. We have the H series here in the U.S., like the H8, H9, and the H10 that didn't make it here to the U.S., but it did appear in Canada. No, or Europe. Not here, anyway.
Well, I mean, usually when we see, we've seen like Vizio did a less expensive version of a television, I want to say for Best Buy, that didn't include the tablet remote control for it.
Sometimes it's simply just a remote change, but otherwise yeah. a similar panel.
Walmart will get special model numbers or special production runs because they're Walmart and they're just such a massive market.
True. Costco does the same thing to prevent yeah. fraudulent returns, other items like that. That's one way to look at it. On this particular TV, though, the specs that jump out at me for the Hisense P8 is it's quantum dot color. That's something that's typically not offered on the 8 series TVs I've seen out of them. That's usually reserved for their very fine TVs, like the H9 in particular, the newest one. That is really nice. That's going to give you terrific color quality with this display. And especially when compared to other quote-unquote wide color gamut LCDs out there that are using the phosphor LEDs as the backlighting system. It's generally a more affordable way to do it, but compared to the quantum dot films and other technologies, it is no match in terms of producing the saturated, brilliant colors that we're used to with something like a 4K streaming source or a 4K Blu-ray, something like that. As far as its HDR format support, it looks like it's a standard HDR 10 display. They list something called HDR Plus. It's spelled different. So I'm not even sure if that's just a marketing term for their version of HDR 10. Either way, it doesn't have Dolby Vision.
Right.
And neither do some other brands like Samsung's TVs. If HDR format support's critical for you, that's something to really consider. If having Dolby Vision support in particular. Maybe you want to save up and get yourself something like a nice OLED down the road.
Right. For anybody listening in the United States who's a little kind of curious about what 3,000 Australian is, it's about, I want to say about 2,100 US.
So. And right now, the P8 he sent us the link to is on sale for about 2,500 even. Or, yeah, I can't tell if they're fours and nines. There we go. Yeah, 2,400, 2,500 even. And that's about $1,800. I think comparatively right now, it would be something like the Samsung Q6 that is also currently on sale right now for, scrolling, $1,700. So within about $100 of each other, $150 of each other. The Q series TVs from Samsung also have quantum dot color. They use the Tizen operating system that's generally very zippy. It's got voice control. It has the gaming features that I really like, including variable refresh rate and, auto game mode for consoles like the Xbox.
Nice.
So if that's important, I would probably lean more toward a Samsung LCD and their QLED lineup rather than that P8 model. And when it comes to factory calibrations, how good is that screen going to look in its calibrated mode right out of the box in a light-controlled room? Mm-hmm. I find companies like Sony in particular is probably number one at doing that. Samsung is a good number two. Generally, those controls for, if you're into calibrating or having it calibrated, you're going to have more granular controls with a Sony or a Samsung compared to something like a Hisense, in my general experience. I think for that much money, for about $1,800, $1,900 US or about, $2,500 Australian, I probably would look elsewhere for a 65-inch screen. I'd go with something in the range of affordability from Samsung if color and gaming are really important. Something maybe from Sony, if you have a chance of, with an update, adding Dolby Vision support down the road, that could be critical. I'd be tempted to look elsewhere than that particular Hisense at that price.
Hopefully that helps you out a bit, Craig. It's, it's something we can try to talk to people about at CES this year, because it's the sort of thing we don't usually get a lot of responses on, or maybe the right people aren't available to answer questions like, why do you have specific models for this country? Which could be as simple as anything like, okay, if they don't have to do Energy Star for that country and they can save money, or maybe it's to deal with,
Well, also, too, for this particular TV, it is dealing with the 50, 100, 200 refresh rate systems.
Right.
That is a little different from, the 60, 30 hertz systems that we use here in North America.
Good point.
So that could be one thing that makes it a little different. It's that spec, though, that lists quantum dot film as part of the spec lineup for that P8. That's just a little different from what I'm used to out of, the H8 series out of Hisense here in North America. I don't believe the H8 actually had quantum dot. I think it was the LED phosphor material,
right,
or the LED phosphor-coated systems. In this case, yeah, I'm going to stick with what I said.
I would
probably look elsewhere, because that budget's approaching $2,000 real quick, US, and I think you could do better. Better and brighter and more colorful.
Other than that, though.
Although it does have the quantum dot.
For everybody. Oh, my goodness. For everybody that's supporting us at Craig, thank you for your email. Hopefully that helps. For everybody who supports us at the dollar a month level or greater, you have early access to the show. You get the show before anybody else. And the early access RSS feed link should have been emailed to you. Check your inbox. And seriously, thank you. Every one of you that supports us on Patreon. Patreon.com/AVXL is the place to go if you want to help keep the show going. And we really, really appreciate it, because you're paying us to do this show. And you're paying so that we don't pay out of pocket to distribute this show, which we really appreciate.
It works in our favor.
You have a new YouTube channel of the week, and I have a YouTube channel that we've fallen in love with here, but you go first.
I just wanted to mention The History Guy, The History Guy, and you can look that up right in YouTube. It's a gentleman who has a channel where he does little snippets of cool things in history, and they're about, say, 10 to 12 minutes long each.
Oh, nice.
And the guy does really good presentations. I think the topics are at times timely and interesting, and he's got a good collection of videos to just sit there and kill an hour easy listening to cool things that have occurred and why it's worth remembering. And often you learn something pretty neat at the same time. And his way of presentation is just, I think it's gotten better over the years. It's an all around terrific channel worth checking out.
Nice.
I'll throw that down. I'm checking his channel every day for new content, and I've gone back and probably watched everything he's ever done. I've learned a lot.
It's good stuff.
In an entertaining way.
Yeah. It's. I'm a big fan of Crash Course. We actually use that in the schooling of the boys.
Nice.
Crash Course is pretty awesome. Flight Test. If you are FLITETEST, the thing that got the boys completely hooked on it was a flying 8-foot A-10 Warthog made from dollar store foam board.
But there you go.
They do all sorts of stuff with sort of low cost and sort of crazy plane builds. They do drone reviews. They made an IKEA chair fly. You know, they do stuff from super inexpensive to super badass, but they're really into making and passing along skills for you to become a better maker, which is pretty awesome to rub the boys up against.
Very cool.
Yeah. Cobuzz, that lossless audio service that's coming out of France, coming to the United States.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned that the other day.
They're supposed to be kind of their hard launch. It was supposed to come out at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. It's interesting. I think possibly the most interesting part of it that I haven't experimented with yet is the ability to buy HD res albums at a reduced price. I don't necessarily believe that the human earball can pick up the gloriousness of HD audio. I've got some friends that
I'm in that same
vehemently
boat.
Disagree with me, but most of the people I know are like, well, if it gives me more of the music that was on the master tape, I'm down with that. I have complicated feels about that I won't get into right now. But my biggest frustration with Cobuzz, at least on the Android platform, has been the tremendous funkiness of the app, which feels late beta more than final product. If you don't mind a little crashing at inappropriate moments, it's probably not too bad. Been spending a lot of time. You actually got to listen to these a little bit more before the show. The Odyssey Mobius gaming
headset. Oh, those are
headset.
Great. You brought those in the other day, but this week you had them with the detachable microphone.
Yeah.
I like the fact that the microphone's detachable.
Yes.
It's like I don't get that on a cheap pair of gaming headphones. It's minor.
Yeah.
But maybe you want to take them on the road and you definitely don't need the microphone hanging around, getting in the way.
Well,
you can get rid of it or just stash it.
It's funny because the thing I like best about them is turning off all of the Waves NX stuff. I'm not a particularly huge fan of a lot of the DSP stuff going on there. And the head tracking does not particularly work for me because it's set up so it'll do
totally
head tracking.
About that part of it.
Yeah. So you can set it up so you can be like, oh, I turn to the right and the band is on my right, or I turn to the left and the band is on my right. I turn to the right and the band is on my left.
I
can do that with a video game. And I have like zero use for that in a video game, and you can't really use it in a VR headset because the VR headset controls the panning of the audio as you turn your head. So all you want is perfect stereo reproduction. So they do a fantastic job playing games, and they do a fantastic job playing audio.
We just can't figure out the use case for this one particular feature that's built
into
it. Yeah,
the stuff that's like, and it's funny because, you know, I don't know how much I whined or didn't whine about OSIC, the OSIC headset, the Kickstarter that I backed that crashed and burned. You know, but a lot of what OSIC was doing is what the Mobius has done, and there's a lot of the stuff where I don't find it particularly useful. The head tracking isn't particularly useful. Now, for content creators and stuff, they've got an interesting sort of upgraded version of this that comes with a bunch of plugins and creation tools, but the thing I want most from this is to, like, keep the mic, keep the planar magnetic, so they came up with a new planar magnetic driver for this, turn off the head tracking and turn off the DSP stuff, because I don't find the DSP stuff and the head tracking stuff particularly useful.
Do those do noise reduction?
They do not do active noise cancellation. And I will say,
I think I'd rather have that than.
Yeah, in a super quiet room, I have also picked up what appears to be a little bit of noise, like when music's paused. But if there's any kind of background noise, it kind of gets subsumed into the background.
Because the over-the-ear design seems to do a pretty good job of sealing. But, yeah, man, if you could pair that with some noise cancellation, that would make those like a perfect airplane trip or office environment or anywhere headphone. In addition to the cool gaming side of it with the with the adjust, I like having a mic on a good that. See, that's the thing. Those are a nice looking pair of wireless headphones that have a microphone on them.
You got all touchy feely with them.
There's just not many options out there. Things with mics on them.
Yeah, but there's you know, it's funny because
you get good headphones at all price points, but
We've talked about several of the wireless ones. I mean, this one's interesting because it'll do like a synthesized 7.1 surround soundtrack, for example, off of Netflix or something, but only over the USB version, not doing the wireless version stuff. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. You got really touchy feely with them. They're an interesting
sound reproduction. Seems solid.
Yeah. Once the music's playing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff going on there.
Super comfy. The build quality, I think, is just glorious looking.
Well, I think it has to be because they're asking $400 for these or $399. So I think they have to feel bomb-proof. They are by far the most plasticky headset I've ever or headphone I've ever seen from Odyssey. Their stuff is usually they do stuff with wood.
There's some weight to it though. They don't feel cheap at all. They feel like $400 headphones.
So, you're a big thumbs up on them.
I would, except for the not unnecessary features, but features I am unlikely to ever use.
Yeah,
are a big part of that design. And I think if you could come up with a V2 that massages it a little bit further, keeps all the basic components, especially with the removable microphone, and then add in that noise cancellation, that would be way more
compelling.
Appealing to me. Yeah. I think a more compelling product, just specifically for me, because you mentioned like for gaming, I'm looking straight on at my computer screen and moving a mouse to handle motion. And I really don't, the audio cues are already changing based upon what I'm doing on the screen. I don't need my head movement then to further screw with me.
One of the things Shannon did was she was kind of frustrated because she would turn her head, the head tracking would change the direction the audio came from, and that would kind of screw up her trying to localize where like a shot was coming from on the screen. I'm still playing around. There's some anatomy calibration stuff I'm still playing with. I'm going to play around with a little bit more of the sort of ambisonics and 3D audio. But I got to say, like, for me, very little of the sort of mock surround sound that's pushed by Dolby particularly and some other vendors, you know, none of it particularly sounds anywhere near as good as having a couple of surround sound channels behind you and three speakers in front of you. You know, you're obviously not going to travel with, you know, five speakers and a subwoofer. And, you know, if I play, Fortnite at 2 a.m. with five speakers and a subwoofer, I'm going to terrify my children and my wife's going to divorce
me. I think
I've
all but given up on having speakers do anything other than be ideal two-channel devices. I'm not really looking for anything to try to simulate 5.1 when I have these two very dynamic drivers positioned perfectly right on each side of my head. And if you can just manipulate everything else, that's all I need.
There's been a lot. It's frustrating because,
at least in terms of the gaming experience.
Yeah. Well, part of it was part of the reason the guys over at Vocal, the guys from JDS Labs that started Vocal, part of the reason they did their headset was simply to deal with the fact that most gaming headsets don't really do very good audio. And that's what's kind of funny about the Mobius is they do very, very good audio. And that's actually by far the best feature of them. And I like that a lot more than all of the additional cruft that's layered on top of that audio. But the flip side also is if you want to play around with the DSP and the sound expansion and the customized, you know, EQ that's supposed to make it easier to hear people sneaking up behind, footsteps mode to hear people sneaking up behind you and stuff, it's there to play with. But, you know, the more I listen to it, the more I tend to use it in the sort of the default tuning or the music tuning more so than any of the gaming specific tuning, because I think a good headphone, an excellent headphone, will give you an excellent gaming audio experience. But
there you go.
I may be insane and completely clueless, but you know,
I got to say also, it's the first time I've wrapped a headphone like 180 degrees around its headband without being terrified, because they were very specific.
Oh, wow.
About, yeah.
That's a flexible headband, man.
I think their goal was to make this sort of angry gamer pitchable proof.
That, so, you could throw those in a backpack or a travel bag, no problem.
I wow. think for I, what they no charge for them, it might be worth getting the actual travel case for them.
Beautiful.
I'm sure they would travel fine in my backpack, but, you know, one should be careful.
Yeah, the more I spend on things, the more I tend to take very, very good care of them, generally speaking.
Oh, my
Don't
goodness.
Don't get me started on USB. You know what? Okay. Totally off topic. Real okay. quick. I am not going to miss micro USB when I leave my current phone and go to a new phone that uses USB-C.
I love USB-C, and I hate micro USB.
Micro USB with those two little hooks. I destroy more cables, like, on a regular basis with those two little hooks getting pushed in. And I finally look up some videos in terms of, like, I'm just throwing away cables after like a week sometimes. I'm apparently quite abusive with the cables. But anyway, I'm not going to miss that USB design at all.
Mm-hmm.
Second only to the standard USB with that rectangle that only goes in one way, but you're guaranteed to never put it in that way the first time. Anyway.
At least it's consistent, right?
Oh man.
I could go off on like a rant about these USB mini cables real for 5-10 minutes, and I'm like, I'm going to stop right there.
I have several devices in my house now that use USB-C.
I'm shocked at how many cables I buy per year. I keep breaking them.
Micro USB is not a particularly awesome format.
Baby those things.
Hey, something that just came in like right before we started recording, Grado, the headphone company.
Yeah.
Makers of the SR60 and the...
Oh, yeah. The classic SR60.
Well, I've been a big fan of the Grado SR80. It's kind of a personal favorite. That was like my first, like the Grado SR80s and then later on the 225s were kind of like my first audiophile headphones. I thought it was kind of fascinating. They announced literally today a wireless headphone, a wireless open-backed headphone.
Oh.
So Bluetooth 4.2 with aptX. I was kind of like, whoa, this is not something I expected from Grado, but the GW100, Bluetooth 4.2, aptX, they're talking about, you know, sort of a 10-meter working distance. I'm really curious to hear them because they're saying 20 hertz, 20,000 hertz on the frequency response. Compared to a lot of the contemporary audiophile headphones, that the bass response on the Grados has been de-emphasized compared to the high end. I'm used to better bass response than I usually get out of the Grado stuff, but I'm very curious to hear this. $249. You know, it looks like a Grado headphone, which I'm kind of fascinated by. They're claiming 15 hours of battery life based on 50% volume throughout the playtime, microphone built into them. Super curious to hear those when they become available to listen to.
But, nice.
Yeah, and apparently they are the world's first open black Bluetooth headphones. So same drivers as the wired headphones, tuned for the enclosure. I'm really curious to see what those sound like. And this is the 65th anniversary of Grado, who still makes their gear in a storefront in Brooklyn, New York. They make the green cartridge. They provided me with a Grado cartridge to use
when
I was going through the great. We talked about this when I did the great unhinged adventure in vinyl.
Everyone goes through it.
Oh yeah,
it afflicts everyone at some point in their life.
You know, I do this about every 5 years. Somebody convinces
me, or it's chronic.
That I'm missing the magic. And it was funny because one of the you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's much more advanced in the acoustic sciences than I am, and he actually loves vinyl and he collects vinyl and he searches for vinyl.
Lunatic.
And he plays vinyl, but he admitted, like, it's not because the audio is better. Like, mechanically, it's worse for any of a number of reasons. But he literally enjoys vinyl so much. So that's a conversation for another day, though.
I think it's off-gassing.
Oh, my
affecting
goodness.
Affecting you.
Well, props to Grado on the new announcement. And I should probably figure out what my children just lit on fire.
Excellent. I see a rolling trash can.
One can only imagine what that might be. And, GradoLabs.com is the website. Nice
Check
group of people over there.
Very cool.
Someday I hope to assemble a set of headphones in their facility.
Very cool.
Yeah, good stuff. I think we mentioned patreon.com/AVXL is the website. AVXL.com. Well, patreon.com/AVXL if you want to donate to the show. AVXL.com is the website. HeronFidelity.com is where he reviews televisions. I may or may not have a new website coming up with a bunch of the audio reviews.
I'm slowly getting my website built back up.
Rebuilt.
Just starting fresh.
Sometimes.
I just got the letter from Google saying, the mobile optimization for your site just sucks, sir. please, please fix that. I'm like, ah, okay. It's affecting your rankings. Not that I'm terribly concerned, but yeah, I realize it's like I go on my own website on my phone. I'm like, this is unusable. So, well, yeah, that's all to be changed relatively soon. Fresh new theme.
Fresh new theme. Shiny, happy themes, people. If you haven't sat down and watched a television show or a movie or listened to an album end to end without being interrupted, just wait till the kids are asleep or your husband's asleep or your wife is asleep or whoever it is, the dog is unconscious. Fire up something and just listen to it end to end. Watch the video. Enjoy the experience. And if you're thinking, could this be better? Email ask@avxl.com because we're listening.
Always.
We love your questions.
Always, man.
Oh, goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
Damn it. The A's didn't make it.
It's okay. There's Thursday night football.
No. There will be no football in this house.
American football. I partake.
It's got boring at some point for me.
I don't even know. I don't know who half these people are playing anymore, but I still get some enjoyment out of it. I think sports betting helps a lot, too.
That probably helps a lot with your enthusiasm.
It makes dog racing exciting. Whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, I watch curl. I got my first VPN so I could pirate
down the
curling
end of the block.
From Canada, so it's not like I'm a rational human being. I can watch golf. Can't play golf. I can watch golf for hours.
I'm not a golfer.
Fascinates me. People in my family who love golf see me swing a golf club. They're like, you should drive the cart. And I'm like, you don't want me? No, we don't want you to. It's painful to watch. Oh, my goodness.
So good.
Look, we saved the diversion for this episode till the end. That's an improvement for us.
Right now, I'm in video game mode, so the TV's the secondary item. I did connect my TV to my workstation to check out the HDR experience. That's just like in Windows. It's like, oh, do you want to enable wide color palette and HDR? Sure. And then it's always on. And you can fine tune it a little
bit.
That
does some odd things to certain content in certain environments.
If you want a really bright TV all the time, it works just fine. And I was able to drive three displays off my one graphics card, no problem. So that was all good. But right now I'm checking out this game called... It's still in beta and it's on Steam right now. And a buddy of mine who knows I like these kind of self-torturing games. It's called They Are Billions. If you like tower defense style games, in a sense, this is pretty cool. With the zombie theme, you basically just build up a village over a set number of days, preparing for that last day when the billions of zombies come rushing you and to see if your defenses are good enough. I have to admit, pretty simple, pretty straightforward, but I'm mildly addicted to it. So I'm working
on it. Billions of
zombies. Billions. And I'm playing on the absolute easiest mode right now, and I'm still getting my butt handed to me. So I gotta check out my YouTube channels that specialize in providing some tutorials and guidance for getting myself up to speed. But it's coming. It's coming along.
Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I am still Robert Herron.
And we're this time, really, we're going to wrap it.
Yeah.
I swear.
We'll go. Well, we'll be back next week.
Absolutely.
Take care. Toodles.